Now, we have this doctrine called the substantial performance doctrine.
These two chapters are so closely related, there are times when I'm sort of jumping into the next chapter and I'm going to cover everything kind of together.
Thank you.
Substantial performance.
If the material breach occurs by somebody who has already, in the eyes of the law, substantially performed the contract, what recovery? Do they get a recovery? Do they breach the contract, do they still get a recovery? Yes. They're going to get their title to be paid. Cost to complete, think of it to keep it simple in terms of billing contract.
No, this is still chapter 19. It's in there somewhere. It's early in the chapter.
Okay.
Okay.
Minus the original contract price.
You got the contract?
Cost of complete involves any expenses that the non-breaching party had, not just what they have to pay a new contractor to come in and finish it. But there may be other expenses that they had to arrange. All of that is built into this cost of complete minus the original contract price. So if there was no addition to the cost of complete, try to keep it as simple as we can. They found somebody to finish it for the same balance of the contract price that the breaching party would have been entitled to. Okay, we got a builder that walks off the job, what we're talking about. Not finishes, leaves an unfinished building sitting there and walks off. If the owner of the building can find somebody else to finish it at the same price it would take the original contracting party to finish it, then they get their contract price minus the cost to complete.
Who gets it?
The breaching party.
Wow. Okay. Even though he walked off the job?
Even though, because it was substantially performed.
Wow.
Courts have never defined exactly what this means. So this is where we run into some problems in equity. That's why I'm not going to have a substantial performance question on the test. Because the courts have never exactly said, what does it take? I mean, for a building, if the foundation is in, is that substantially performed? The basement's for the building, the foundation is there, footings are there, they're just starting to put the structure together, and they walk off the dock. Is that substantial? It's less than half, but is that substantially performed? The cases are all over the map on that. So this is something to be aware of if you're going into business. I'm just not sure what a court might decide whether a contract is substantially performed or not.
So I would maybe substantial performance. They give, say the owners give me $100,000 to build this house, and they say start, building it, say 6 months from now. And they say it's $100,000.
By the way, it's called an executory contract.
But at any point at $100,000, I'm not supposed to go past $100,000. So if I pour, you said, get a quarterway through, and it's $100,000, and that's what you hired me to do.
Okay, but the contract is going to say how much each step along the way. What did it cost for that basement? What were the materials and labor for that basement? What part of the contract is that?
So it seems like they say they don't want to spend any more than this, and it's like contract, they don't want to spend more than that. And Teresa, even though you're signing a contract to build their whole house, would that be substantial enough? Would that be roughly what they're talking about or not?
To me, if I'm the judge, the foundation is not enough for a substantial performance. Not enough. To me, if I'm the judge, if it's not half done, I'm not going to rule that it's substantially performed. The law is not real settled on this. But I want to tell you, what is the case when it's not substantially performed? The court ruled that some work was done, but it's not substantially performed. And these people walk off the job. Are they entitled to anything? Reasonable labor costs, and that's it. Why? Because of implied in law contract. That's work that's been done, and that doesn't have to be redone. And so the owner benefited from it. But now we don't worry about contract rights anymore. So you had what? 5 employees over there.
Right.
You had 5 employees over there working for 5 days. What did you pay them? That's about it. That's all they're going to get.
Denying the material.
And if you brought your materials and you didn't use the building owner's materials, what was the cost of those materials that you used? Plus, what was your labor cost? That's going to be pretty much it. Labor cost. Materials reimbursement if there wasn't any. When the work was not substantially performed. All right. Problems. Number 1 on 429. Where did we leave off? Did we finish that roll?
We did.
Mike, want to pass, Mike? All right. Next. The Casey, is it?
Yep.
Number one.
The cloning contractor has made a contract with three machines to build an apartment house for a specific site. A number of serious apartment house fires broke out with the city council adopted an ordinance increasing the fire precautions that had to be taken in the construction of the new building. Compliance with these new requirements would make the construction of the apartment house to reach the city of Long Beach that McMullen had originally contemplated. So McMullen is charged from the contract to build the apartment house.
Casey, do we have enough facts to answer this? It's always okay as an answer to say not enough facts to answer as long as you can explain why. You see that in an essay. We need more facts. Here's what we need. No. It's more expensive. What do you mean, a nickel? A dollar? $10? We don't know how much more expensive. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but I'm making a point. We don't know how much more expensive. And you know what a judge sitting in equity is likely to do? If this increased cost was truly not reasonably foreseeable to either party, allocated between the parties. That's called the equitable remedy of reformation of a contract. See, in business law, we not only have novation, we have reformation, which is not brought since the 17th century.
Is that a little wrong? I was reading this with the frustration of purpose doctrine.
No, frustration of purpose doctrine is virtually the same thing as impossibility of performance. It's the same thing. What I'm trying not to do is give you 7 different terms to learn to mean they're virtually the same thing, because this is not law school. You don't need to worry about frustration of purpose. Frustration of purpose means I can't do the contract. There's a whole basis for doing it that doesn't exist anymore. So to me, that's, for our purposes, that's the same thing as impossibility of performance. We don't know let's assume that it made it 3 times. It was like triple the expense, triple the cost, KP. Then what? Greater the cost, the more likely you're going to be able to get away from the possibility argument.
According to this right here, it says that as soon as the law changes and makes that building illegal to build the way it is, then it charges you from the contract right there on 14.1.
He can make the argument subsequent change in the law makes it allows the contract for me to consider it to be discharged. He can make that argument. But it isn't really an impossible contract. The question is, there's some unforeseeable increased costs. And the way to do it is to allocate that between the parties to make comparable parties. And if not, of course, you can do that sitting there. Number four, Emily?
Rural Tractor made a contract to design a new Shortly after the contract was made, the Metal Factory and the Lawrence Center was killed in the automobile accident, and Metal Factory was not able to design the part of the Metal Center. Lamar sued Metal Factory for damages for breach of the contract. Metal Factory claims that the contract was taken from the
ground. It's not impossible. All they got to do, Emily, is get a new designer, right? Dime a dozen, aren't they?
Well, if he died and he was like part of the contract.
But what was he, akin to the janitor? No, it says they were depending on the genius of this person.
Well, he wasn't
the genius of this person as the head of the research department to design a new product. They based the whole contract on the fact that it was this guy that was, or woman, we don't know, we don't know the gender. This person that was going to design. And so we're going to spend our money because this person's involved. Right? So, Collins Foxhole, this could be a situation of frustration of purpose.
I think the contract's still liable, though. Like, it's still good because if that guy didn't write his name on the contract or it wasn't in the contract.
Contract is considered to be discharged because this person's not available to design the product. And the whole thing was based upon this person's illness.
Yeah, but even what if the contract has nothing saying nothing about this guy saying, yeah, we'll just do it?
Well, you're changing the facts. If you're changing the facts, you can get a different result.
Because, like, it doesn't say, like, in the problem, it says they're depending on him, but in the contract, you know, there's not the fact of the contract saying that in the contract, you know, if they just sign it, the CEO signs it saying, yeah, we'll do it because we have this guy in the bag.
We could use some more facts here. How difficult was and how high-tech, state-of-the-art was this? And is this the kind of thing that's fairly routine and anybody, any other designer could have done? Yeah, we had those facts, that might help us. But we don't have that. And so they're going to get out of this contract because they wouldn't have done it without Santa.
And Lamar might have peeled off
Santa. That's one way to get that there, yeah. That's one way to stick in my killing person. And so, Lawrence Henry, you get right into number five here.
The Tenchers signed a contract to sell land to Creasy. The contract specified that the sales transaction was to be completed in 90 days.
And what do we call that?
Time is of the essence.
No, time is of the essence is time is of the essence. You need to use those exact words. This is called what? Condition. The condition was got to be completed within 90 days. We're going to do this contract, got to do it within 90 days, that's the condition.
At the end of 90 days.
Time is of the essence, by the way, means now, right away. Go ahead.
All right. At the end of 90 days, Creasy requested an extension of the time. The Tenchers refused to grant the extension and started that the contract was terminated. Creasy claimed that the 90-day clause was not binding because the contract did not state the time. Was it the essence? Was the contract terminated?
You don't have to put time as of the... Well, I don't answer for you. You answer.
Well, you just said earlier, in Lyle's reading out, you said it's a condition, so if it's actually written in the contract saying the condition of the contract, it must be completed in 90 days, then...
Why be ambiguous when you can be specific?
Yeah.
You don't need the time as of the essence if you're going to put in there the number of days. The problem is, lots of times you really can't. You can't determine how many days it's going to be for some jobs. And so you can protect yourself to some extent by having a time of the essence, which a judge understands what that means. But if you can put a period of time, you're better off doing that. And did the other party, were they obligated to agree to increase the 90 days?
They could have.
There's no consideration to support it, pre-existing duty, right? They didn't have to. I mean, they could have. They want to be a nice guy. They could have. They didn't have to. They weren't given any consideration in exchange for it.
You also say
and if they were given consideration in exchange for it, that would be called a what? Mick Jagger rule? Come on. Accord and satisfaction. That means that as the parties were going along, You change something. But they exchange consideration for changing something. Consideration is usually money.
On the other side, okay. You say...
They didn't have to.
On the other side, you say if there wasn't enough facts, because it didn't say what, like, how hard the, like, the project was, so if there was, like, an unlike reasonable amount of time, can it still be a contract?
I mean, the guy says, I got him on the hook for 90 days, and I'm not letting him off the hook. That's what I bargained for, and he's going to have to do it. Unless he's going to offer me something that adjusts the price in exchange for me doing it, then I might. Seven, Lucas.
Dixon contracted to build a house for Moran. When it was approximately 25 to 40% complete, Moran would not let Dixon work anymore because he was not following the building plans and specifications, and there were many defects. Moran...
What's called a what?
What's that?
What's that called?
A material breach.
Material breach. He spotted a material breach by the other party, and he said, stop, in the name of love. Like, come take that like this. Springs. Go ahead.
Moran hired another contractor to correct the defects and finish the building. Dixon sued Moran for breach of contract, claiming that he had substantially performed the contract up to a point where he had been discharged. Was Dixon correct? I don't think so.
Do we have enough facts?
Well, we know that it's only 25 to 40% of the way done, and it's full of errors. I don't think it's substantially performed.
You don't really know if full of errors, that could be the guy...
If
well,
it's
Dixon isn't saying
argument, then you have a stronger argument than to say it's not that it wasn't substantially performed. It was defectively performed, which is a failure of consideration. You're not required to, just think of it. You would be required to pay somebody for screwing up your work, screwing up your house? No.
Would Dixon still be entitled to labor and material costs that they had put in? That were then used and not replaced by the secondary contractor?
If they were used and not replaced, even though they were defective, yes.
Right, because presumably not everything they did is wrong.
You're not ever entitled to a double recovery, except in very limited circumstances, and we'll cover that along the way. A few provisions in the law for triple damages. That's what I want. All right. 11, Mr. Eastwood.
Metropolitan Park District of Tacoma gave Griffith a concession to run the district's parks. The agreement gave the right to occupy the parks and use any improvements found therein. The district later wished to set this agreement aside because it was not making sufficient money from the transaction. While it was seeking to set the agreement aside, a boathouse and a gift shop in one of the parks were destroyed by fire. The district then claimed that the concession contract with Griffith was discharged by the impossibility of performance. Was it correct?
Do you have enough facts here to establish impossibility of performance? Does it say that? Did those two things... It doesn't say whether or not they're going to be replaced with insurance money. It doesn't say that. Does it say that that was the only way that it could make money, those two things that burned out?
No. It says that they could use the improvements, but they were basically have the right to occupy the parks. And
they made a bad deal.
Sell stuff. Yeah.
You can't use the possibility of performance to get you out of every bad deal you get into. And so I would say... Based on these facts alone, not enough to establish a possibility of performance. Speaking of these facts alone, Mike Prime pointed out to me during the break, and for those of you that are going to work on these cases, you can get a whole lot more information about your case online. How do they do that, Mike? And I strongly recommend that all of you, including the judges, do that.
Findacase.com.
And you type in the site here. It's at the end of each case. That's at the site.
On the park one here, can Metropolitan Park argue an impossibility to perform on Griffith's part, who doesn't want out of the contract, even though Metropolitan is not the one that has to perform it? Griffith has to perform. Metropolitan says it's void because Griffith can't perform.
The possibility argument means that I can't perform, I can't make any money at all, and this will be substantially injurious to my business based upon unforeseeable circumstances that I did not create or I was not responsible for. That's what it takes. And so, yeah, I mean, if they're going to make absolutely no money and it was based upon an unforeseeable circumstance that they did not create, they can make the argument and they may win. And this is subjective. This is, you know, you get to. This is an area of the law where the judge's biases sometimes come into play. You get the more liberal-leaning, Democratic Party-type judges, and they're going to be easier to pull the switch to say impossibility of performance. You get the more conservative-leaning judges, they're going to be more in a marketplace business. You know, business people take risks. Don't be coming in and trying to bail yourself out in this court or the situation you're in. So you hit that link that Mike gave you, and then type in the space there, this little site at the end, and you'll get more information about your case. And you can use that information in your arguments, and the court can hear the decisions.
Okay. Quick on that thing where it says citation, there's two buttons up there. One of them says something else, and the other one says citation. You've got to click on the one that says citation, and then just ask for the... Those are numbers down the bottom, 451-T2D-791.
And so if your opponent is using information because he got the expanded information and you didn't, then you're going to be at a disadvantage. That's the way it goes. Okay, so number 12, Mr. Bing.
Suburban Power Piping Corporation, under contract to construct a building for LTV Steel Corporation, made a subcontract with Power and Pollution Services Incorporated to do some of the work. The subcontract provided that the subcontractor would be paid when the owner, LTV, paid the contractor. LTV went into bankruptcy before making the full payment to the contractor, who then refused to pay the subcontractor on the ground that pay when paid provision of the subcontract made payment by the owner a condition precedented to the obligation of the contractor to pay the subcontractor. Was the contractor correct?
This is very interesting because here's the question. When you agree the language in a written contract, can you always get around that by claiming implied in law contract to avoid an unfair result? Which would be their only argument. What do you think, Jason?
With what?
What do you think here? Can the sub still collect from the general or not? And if he can't, what would his argument be?
Well, they made an agreement before.
Right, so the pay when paid.
Yeah.
But you can't because bankruptcy means you can't legally force him to pay. So what would his argument be then? To get around that.
That they...
Implied in law contract? He knew I wasn't going to do this work not to get paid.
Uh-huh.
He benefited from it, but did he benefit from it? He's not getting paid.
No.
So how can the sub argue that the general is benefiting when the general is not getting paid?
Why? Because they started the contract before that they went into bankruptcy. So this way they're not going to be able to do any of the services promised.
And a general would going to be crazy to go ahead and hire all these subs without that kind of language in there to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering.
You got to always in business. You got to protect yourself every way.
I was wondering because you invested yourself so deeply into the project that its costs were.
Probably the best argument is going to be to sue the homeowner for fraud. Mm-hmm. Fraud is not a fraud. Judgment is not dischargeable from bankruptcy. That's one way to get around bankruptcy. If somebody commits fraud against you, they can't turn around and file bankruptcy and avoid paying the money.
Is that because it was already established?
That's just because of the way the bankruptcy law is written. Bankruptcy can't be used to insulate a person from fraud because fraud involves intentional deceit and misconduct like that.
So the subcontract, sorry, would be C. In your ABC,
right.
He can go right back to A, even though he's written in the
No, he's going to lose against the general because he agreed and negotiated that pay-when-paid provision. He realized he couldn't get paid But the general didn't get paid. And, maybe his only remedy is, well, maybe the general did get paid some, and maybe I can get some of it, even if I don't get $100. Chapter 20, we've already covered some of this stuff already tonight. Chapter 19 and 20 kind of go together, they kind of blend in. Anticipatory breach, right on page 434, we talked about that. Anticipatory repudiation, we need the same thing. Because once a party has told you they're not going to perform, that's a breach. And it gives you the right to consider a contract discharge. That's the way you want to go. But remember, that party has choices. That's going to come up on the next test. Waiver of breach, 436. If you're the non-breaching party, you can waive any liability. Waiving means I'm not going to exercise my right to go after you and sue you for this. It's okay. I'll accept the work that you did even though there was a breach. And frequently what happens is the parties adjust the price. I'll take it as you got it, but you know this isn't what it was supposed to be. You're going to have to really go down on the price. Frequently happens. Remedies upon breach of contract, page 438, where we talked about for repudiation, the choice that you have, three choices when you're the non-breaching party. Remedies in general and the measure of damages, beginning on the bottom of 438. We've been talking about equitable remedies frequently. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll come back to money damage remedies. Again, remember that equitable remedies is any remedy you're asking from a judge that does not involve payment of money. It's anything else but money. Because that isn't what you want in a particular situation. I don't just want the money. He started it, I want him to finish it. He's got my goods that I paid for. Judge, they've even got my logo on them, but he won't deliver them to me. Order him to deliver me my goods that I paid for. Equitable remedy. You can get an equitable remedy when you can show the judge that money damages will not cure the harm. You have to make a showing to the judge. The way it should be written is not that way. It will not make me whole. The whole purpose of a remedy is to put the non-breaching party back in a position they would be in if there had never been a breach. Make me whole. Make me to the point where I haven't lost anything because of what that schmuck did. And you have to show that the, and now I'm calling it equity remedy, means the same thing. Will not violate public policy. One example of that we've already talked about tonight. I'm just not going to order somebody to perform personal services. You got a singer that doesn't want to perform. They want to, and they anticipatorily breach the contract, as performers frequently do, and to try to cancel it. I'm not coming to that concert then. And the concert promoter wants to sue them and get to force them to come. Judges are very reluctant to do that. Because of public policy reasons, because it's going to create more litigation. It's going to create another lawsuit once they show up to give a half-assed performance. Then there's another lawsuit that's going to be filed. But there's another way to backdoor it and make sure that the person comes and performs. The equitable remedy that you get will order them not to perform anywhere else that night. And that'll have the effect. Because they want to be able to make money, that'll have the effect to get them to show up. So that's the way you handle that. You establish these two things, and you can get an equitable remedy. Of course, what else do you have to establish? No latches or unclean hands, right? Equitable defenses. We talked about first night in class. Yep. latches. You have to show you didn't wait too long to come to court to try to get this person forced to do something. And no unclean hands, you have to show that you acted in good faith at all times. You didn't do anything underhanded. You didn't do anything to cause that person to fail to show up to perform. So these are kind of the preliminary things to be able to be eligible to get an equitable remedy from a judge, an equitable order. These remedy means to cure the problem of this breach. Order is how the judge forces that person to comply to make sure that you're made whole at the end of the day and you get what you bargained for roughly at that price. Now, I can put a list of them all on the board, but there's so many of them. Specific performance means judge order them to perform the contract. Rescission means judge enter an order saying we're both discharged. Rip up the contract. Reformation, judge, this contract is substantially unfair. He didn't tell me certain things that he had a duty to tell me. He was being underhanded, and had he told me these facts, he knows I never would have entered into that contract, certainly not at that price. So judge, in order to make this fair and give us both the chance to benefit from this contract, change it to a certain extent. That's called reformation. You get the equitable remedy. You convince the judge. You're qualified for it. You made a good convincing argument. So the judge then enters an order ordering this person to do something that you want him to do. And then he doesn't do it. How do you enforce it? Show cause act. Getting back into legal procedure a little bit. You prepare a petition and you set forth the facts showing that this person's intentionally violated the judge's equitable order. And then you ask that this person be ordered to come and show cause on a particular date and time as to why they should not be held in contempt of court for violating the judge's equitable order. Contempt of court means fines. Heavy fines, possibly. That's civil contempt of court. It can become criminal contempt of court if they violate the judge's next order or they fail to appear. That can become criminal contempt of court. And whenever it's criminal, then it can serve time in jail. But never more than 6 months. Because the United States Constitution guarantees the right to a jury trial for any incarceration 6 months or longer. And no judge is going to give anybody a jury trial in a civil contempt case. No judge in his right mind would ever do that. So 6 months is pretty much the extent of them. You don't need to know that for one of my tests. If you take my criminal procedure class, you do. But not for this class, not for 6 months. So that's how you enforce an equitable remedy. Now let's talk about money damages. One we already mentioned tonight, compensatory. Compensatory is what it takes to make you whole. Partially whole, and you'll see why in a few minutes when we get to another one here. So let's kind of say it a little bit differently so it's a little bit clearer. Compensatory damages almost always simply mean contract price. So we put the party back in the position they would be in had there not been any breach. I get my money back. Or if I'm the one that delivered, if I'm the one that performed a bunch of labor, I get that price of that labor that was in the contract. Or my cost in delivering these goods. Preparing these goods. I get what I should have got in the contract that I didn't get because he breached it. Those are compensatory damages. And we have incidental damages. If you have them, you can get them. Out-of-pocket costs in dealing with the problem. Expenses. expenses in dealing with the breach, which can include lawyer's fees. Lawyer's fees. Let's say you had some products that weren't picked up like they were supposed to be, that require refrigeration and storage. You had to pay for their refrigeration and storage to make sure that they didn't spoil. That's one of your out-of-pocket cost expenses in dealing with the breach. Court costs can certainly be that. A shipping cost that you didn't expect to have. Oh, geez. Now I got to ship these things back. I don't want them here. I don't want to have to store all this stuff. I got to ship this stuff back. This is no good. This is material breach. This is not what I ordered. It's defective. I don't want it. So now I got to pay, because he won't come and pick it up, I got to pay a trucker to send it back. Shipping cost, because the other party breached the contract. Incidental damages. And literally running out of chalk here. And the last one is consequential damages. We have a fourth one, but it's very, very limited. I'll get to that in a minute. Consequential damages are lost profits. I think somebody alluded, it might have been Collins, somebody alluded to this tonight. Maybe it was Joe, I'm not sure. One of you did, I don't remember. Consequential damages are lost profits. Look, you didn't just do this contract for the contract price. That's not what you're in business for. You're in business to turn around what you get from this other guy, do something to it, and resell it at a profit. That's what you're in business for. And so just getting the contract price, yeah, it just means you got your money back, but you were denied profit that you expected to make on the transactions, so the whole reason why you're in business. Lost profits. Or a benefit, financial benefit that you would have received if the contract had not been breached. Lost profits is the easiest way to describe it. But there's a rule, it's an ancient rule. It goes all the way back to a famous case in England called the Hadley versus Baxendale. I'm sure no one cares to know that, but just like the unclean hands rule goes back to a famous case in England called the Highwayman's case. Back to tort law again. Reasonably foreseeable. We do use this in contract law. Here's what this means. These lost profits have to have been reasonably foreseeable to the breaching party for you to be able to recover consequential damages in your lawsuit against them for breach of the contract. So he had to know the business you were in. This is your argument. He knew the business you were in. He knew what you did with the materials that he delivered to you, and how you converted them into your own products to resell and make a profit. He knew that. And so it was reasonably foreseeable to him when he breached the contract that I would lose those profits. So that makes it a damage that you can recover. Money damages. Money damages are called legal remedies as opposed to equitable remedies when you're not seeking money damages. Any question about that? Now there's a fourth one. We don't really have punitive damages in Michigan. You may have heard that term. Some states do. In Michigan, in very limited cases, have what they call exemplary damages. And it's for fraud. Fraud cases, intentional deceit, misconduct. Somebody is a con job. We got a huckster out there in the marketplace going around deceiving and conning people out of their money and goods and property. If that fraud is proven, the court can award exemplary damages in whatever amount they think is appropriate. It's just a way to pile on against that defendant to try to put them out of business. And kind of send a message that you commit fraud and you're going to get whacked big time in court. So exemplary damages mean the same thing as punitive damages, but Michigan just doesn't call them punitive damages. Michigan calls them exemplary damages, and it's for fraud cases. So
since they're based on fraud, are they, if you go bankrupt, are you still obligated to pay those?
Okay, that's a two-step process. First, you've got to convince the bankruptcy judge that was true fraud to take it out of bankruptcy court. Once you win that case, now you have all your remedies again, and you can go to state court. Duty to mitigate damages. Mitigation is talked about in 441. This means that the public is another public policy rule. We don't want people going out, and I think Morris referred to this earlier today, taking actions to run up their damages to make them as high as possible against the person you're going to sue. Duty to mitigate damages means that you have a duty, when you're the non-breaching party, to take reasonable steps to recover your losses and keep your losses down as much as possible. This is a rule to help cases keep people from coming into court. This is, so let's say you're the grocer, and when the bananas arrive, they're not green like they should be. Give you some time to gradually have them go to yellow before you sell them. They're already yellow when you get them. So what does this mean? You've got to drop the price. Significantly. You have to move. So rather than, oh, material breach, I'm going to leave these things out on the curb for him to come and pick up. Duty to mitigate damages says you should try and sell them at a lower price, and then you can come back and seek compensatory damages against that warehouse or whoever delivered those things to you when you weren't in the condition they should have been in. Landlord-tenant situations. This comes up. You got a new job in Grand Rapids and you have to leave. Well, you've got 8 months to run on your lease. And you have to go. I mean, that's a job, and you have to go, and you have to leave. And they say, no, we got you on the hook for 8 more months. So the apartment complex, the landlord has a duty to mitigate their damages and try to seek somebody else to come in and rent those premises. As long as the landlord, we're going to talk about landlord-tenant more later, but as long as the landlord can establish that they took reasonable measures to try and advertise and made an effort to find somebody but could not, then they can collect for the balance of the rent. Because then they exercise their duty to mitigate the damages and still couldn't find somebody to come in. But they can't just sit back and say, no, we're not going to do anything, we're just going to collect the 8 months from you. Can't do that.
Would you just do that in small claims then? Or do you have to go to the landlord-tenant?
It depends on how much money we're talking, because small claims is limited to $3,500. So it depends on how many months left and how high the rent is and whether you're going to be over the limit. Sometimes people, even when they're a little bit over the limit, they still go to small claims just because it's faster and cheaper. You get a remedy and no lawyers involved. And once you've had business law one, then you want to go to small claims because you know you've got the advantage over your opponent because you know the law and they know, right? That's what we do. Okay, so the duty to mitigate damage, keep that in mind. Sometimes the parties put a provision in the contract to deal with damages in the event there's going to be a breach. That's a very smart thing to do. Anything that you can do to lock out judges and lawyers from your business, you want to do that. You can do it. It keeps your cost of doing business a little bit more predictable. And we're talking about a liquidated damages clause. I'm out of chalk, so I'm just going to talk. Liquidated damages clause means that the parties put a provision in their contract that says, if you don't deliver me my raw materials for my business by November 1st, you owe me X amount of dollars for each day you're late. And so we know what the remedy is, and we know that there isn't going to be somebody who runs into court to try to get some vindictive judge on your rear end. That you determine the measure of damages between yourselves. The reason why sometimes you see work workmen out on a highway project at 3 o'clock in the morning with those ultra-huge lights, which they're going to need to work in the dark, is because of liquidated damages clauses in construction contracts. Because they have to work around the clock because they're going to run it over, and there's a liquidated damages provision in their contract that says they don't have that road work for each day they don't have that road work done, they owe so much off the price of the contract. So they're losing money for each day they don't have that work completed. Like, for example, an I-75 contract, a road contract, they've got to get it done, obviously, by October 1st, certainly by November 14th, if not by bow season. They got to get it done by firearm season because of all the traffic that's going to be headed up north. And so they put these deadlines in. That's a liquidated damages clause. Now, there's a rule, and we do have a multiple choice question on the next test on this. There's a rule on liquidated damages provisions for them to be enforced. Again, keep in mind that public policy reasons sometimes trust contract law. We've already seen that in a number of situations. If the liquidated damages provision, in the opinion of the judge, is extremely unfair to one party or the other, the court will not enforce it. So the liquidated damages provision has to be at least a reasonable attempt to estimate what the actual damages would be. It doesn't have to be exact to be enforced. It can be off to some extent. But if it's way, way, way off, then what it is one party trying to annihilate the other party. And the judge isn't going to do that in sitting in equity.
Our early termination fees that I have in, like, my cell phone contract, are these liquidated damages to say if you terminate early, you're going to pay extra?
That's right. In cell phone contracts, they have those now.
Well, I've got them, yeah.
So if you want to keep, if you're the one drafting the contract in your business, and you want to keep the judge and the lawyer out of it, and you want to liquidate the damages provision in there, at least try to make it ballpark estimate of what the actual cost would be. Okay, problem 3, I think we're coming to the front. You want to do 3, Mike?
You're doing a good job. Rogers made a contract with Salisbury Brick Corporation. Rogers made a contract with Salisbury Brick Corporation that allowed to remove earth and sand from the land he owned. The contract ran for 4 years with provision to renew it for an additional 4-year term up to a total of 96 years. The contract provided for compensation to Rogers based on the amount of earth and sand removed. By an unintentional mistake, Salisbury underpaid Rogers the amount of $863 for the months of November and December of 1986. Salisbury offered this amount to Rogers, but he refused to accept it. He claimed that he had been underpaid in other months. Rogers claimed that he was entitled to rescind the contract. Was he correct?
Is it a material breach as to him?
I think he was right.
What if they tender him the check? Send them the check in there, which would be $1,726.
And you should pay it, right? I guess I don't know.
Well, that he was old, then you shouldn't. I mean, you shouldn't go all out and be like, "Oh, I'm going to rescind the contract and give them this." I mean, it's not.
I don't think there's enough facts here to consider him a material breach as to him.
They weren't trying not to pay him. They weren't saying, well, we're not going to pay you.
It doesn't say whether or not he did. He kept working knowing they were underpaying him either. So they tender him the check, they're okay. Otherwise, they consider a material
could
breach.
Could he hit him up for the interest value of that dollar that they missed?
I don't think so. It's got to be in the contract. Okay, you've got to have a contract with them that says that if they underpay him, they're entitled. He's entitled to interest. That's got to be that's a consequential damage. It would have to be reasonably foreseeable. By the way, what does that company serve their employees for lunch?
Sandwiches.
Salisbury steak. Four.
contractor departed from the specifications that a number of employees and a contractor built a house. The cost to put up the house in the condition called for by the contractor was approximately $14,000. The contractor was bid for $50,000 for breach of contract and emotional
disturbance. You owe me $14,000! And he fell apart emotionally. Can you get that?
No.
That's not a compensatory. That's not an out-of-pocket expenses. And that's not a reasonably foreseeable consequential. I can't get it. But I won't invoke the rule on you there. Six.
The buyer of real estate made a down payment. The contract stated that the buyer would be liable for damages in an amount equal to the down payment if the buyer broke the contract. The buyer refused to go through with the contract and demanded his down payment back. The seller refused to return it and claimed he was entitled to additional damages from the buyer because the damages that he had suffered were more than the amount of the down payment.
Sounds like a reasonable argument to me. How about you? Well, what did they negotiate for? Down payment. Would be returned if there's a breach, and that's of course called a liquidated damage to this, right? That they both negotiated and put in their contract. But then the one party says, no, I want more because my actual damages were more than a down payment. Do we have enough facts here to support that argument? No. How much more? A nickel, a dime, a dollar. You can't assume things, for one thing, right? And did he have reason to believe he would have more damages than just a down payment at the time he negotiated that provision? If this is all based on information he had from day one when he negotiated that provision, then he can't say that this is an unfair liquidated damages provision. Since he negotiated it, okay. And we don't know how much more. Okay, number nine. Ringo Starr once said at the back of the Beatles song.
Melody Lane Laundry Company was a tenant in a building that was protected against fire by a sprinkler and alarm system maintained by the American District Telegraph Company. Because of the latter's fall, controls on the system were defective and allowed the discharge of water into the building, which damaged Melody's property. When Melody sued ADC, its defense was that its service contract limited its liability to 10% of the annual service charge made to its customer. Was this imitation valid?
Does it say what the annual service charge was? Is there any way to say whether or not that 10% of the annual service charge is adequate or even in the ballpark to cover damage from discharge of water into the building? We don't have enough facts. It probably is not an enforceable reason for the liquidated damages provision. But I don't know if we have enough facts to say that. That seems like it would be the discharge of water in the building would be a substantial expense. But probably not enough facts to decide.
The book indicated that liquidated damages had to not only not be unfair, but also had to be in a situation where it's difficult or impossible to determine the actual loss in the case of a breach. So in this instance, assuming that's correct, in this instance it should be fairly easy to determine actual losses. I mean, if you melt down all my stuff in your water, I can add it all up and tell you the actual losses.
If this was not a foreseeable...
Oh, it's foreseeable that sprinklers will break.
If it's not a foreseeable loss, then the party did not have an adequate reason to build that into a liquidated damages provision, build that loss into it. And we don't know what 10% of the annual service charge is, whether that would cover the water damage. So I don't think we can answer this one. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you need more facts. Sometimes a publisher didn't give us enough facts in the case. And this is an example. All right. Ten.
In May, a homeowner made a contract with a roofer to make repairs to her house by July 1st. The roofer never came to repair the roof, and heavy rains in the fall damaged the interior of the house. The homeowner sued the roofer for breach of contract and claimed damages for the harm done to the interior of the house. The homeowner entitled to recover such damages.
This is a good thing. Okay. So we're talking about compensatory damages here. Is there a doctrine or a principle that might cover the situation that we talked about tonight? Well, let me put it this way. What would be the roofer's argument as to why the roofer is not responsible? He has an argument. What is it? Any idea? Well, think of it in terms of common sense, and maybe even don't be hung up on contract law right now. If you were the homeowner, well, what would you have done? And he doesn't show up on July 1st. What would you? What's that?
Try getting the whole homeowner.
And if you can't, what would you have done? Pardon me?
I don't know.
Would you just go into the winter and say, I just want to get in touch with nature? Or would you take some other action? To protect yourself so that the stuff in your house doesn't get damaged. That's what you would do because you have common sense. Sometimes, if you just put contract law aside and don't get hung up on it, you can think of what you would do in a situation of common sense. It's easy to answer it. So we're talking about the duty to mitigate damages here. Right? Did she have a duty when there was a material breach here on July 1st, when she's exposed to this kind of potential damage? And it does usually rain heavy in the fall, as we all know. Does she have a duty to take other action before damage occurs? Yes. And of course, if she has to pay more, then she can sue the roofer for compensatory damages so that she's made whole. So she doesn't have to end up paying more than what that original contract price was. That's the roofer's argument. Does anybody want to make a color argument on behalf of this lady?
Well, maybe she tried that and she couldn't get a contractor to come do her roof in time.
Yeah, she can say, that's right. We had to actually get a different result. That's one argument. In other words, she couldn't get anybody else to do it. Although there's an awful lot of people crawling around out there in Michigan desperate for work, and a lot of them can do roofs, but that might not be such a strong argument. The other argument could be, I just didn't have time as of the essence in my agreement. I didn't know when he was coming. I thought he was coming. I lost track of time. I'm busy. He didn't say he wasn't coming. I was waiting for him to come. He didn't say he anticipatorily repudiated it, does it?
It said the contract was to have it done by July 1st.
But he never said he wasn't going to do it. He might just say, well, time was out of the essence. I was going to get to that when I could get to it. That would be... that would be her argument that, I thought he was still going to get to it. And so I didn't know, I wasn't in a position to be able to. And all of a sudden we got the heavy rains, and I couldn't, it was too late for me to do anything about it once the heavy rains came. See, when you get these, as we're going to do in class, I want you to be able to make arguments both ways. At first glance, you might see that. Start digging in there, start thinking about it, start thinking public policy, exceptions to rules, why the rule shouldn't apply, and sometimes you can come up with another argument. Okay, 12. 12 and 13, then we'll be done for the night.
Or may I ask me? There you go, back down.
Okay. Should be Collins. I usually zigzag like that.
Was no work for panels under a 3-year contract setting that. If the contract was terminated wrongfully by Carlos before the end of the 3 years, he would pay a damages for salary for the remaining time that the contract had. To run after 3 months, Carlos terminated the contract and Wozniak.
Well, sports, this is what you have. You get rid of a player on your team, you got to pay the rest of the contract. Go ahead.
And Wozniak sued him for pay for the balance of the contract term. Carlos claimed that this amount not be covered because of the contract provision for the payment was a void penalty.
Void penalty means the judge isn't going to enforce the liquidated damages provision because it's unfair. It's too unfair. What do you think, Alice?
I didn't know what type of work he was doing or anything. He just said, or what he was paying with us, right? And I was like, well, if it was like he was making a lot of money during that job for 3 months or whatever, it was in that contract, then I guess I would speak to the terms of the contract.
Yeah, and the guy's argument can be, you know, if I didn't have this, I could have signed another contract. This is the argument you're getting sports. I could have signed another contract and I had been paid, but I, you know, I relied on him to be a man of his word, a company of their word, and he agreed to be responsible to pay me for 3 years. Or I could have gone somewhere else. There's usually a provision of these contracts that say that if you do go work someplace else, then they don't have to pay you the rest.
Now, do you have a duty to go try and work somewhere else, since you have a duty to mitigate damages?
You have a duty to mitigate damages, that's only when there's no written contract. If there's a written contract, the contract will.
Would it make
the contract says you do, then you do.
Would it make any difference if you were, because it says wrongfully terminated was in terms of the contract, what if you were terminated and he ripped off?
Right, wrongfully terminated means he could sue and get a specific performance remedy anyway. So the liquidated damages provision is not unfair. If he was wrongfully terminated, he could have sued and got a judgment to be paid for that period of time. Anyway, because he was wrongfully terminated. So there was a material breach as to him.
So then he would be entitled to
that. Yeah, so the liquidated damages provision would fit. It would not be unfair, since he's going to win the lawsuit anyway because he was wrongfully terminated. Yet he sued because he didn't have the liquidated damages provision, he would have to sue. He'd end up the same way. 13. Last for tonight. Joe?
So then the contractor, any contract to build a house for apartment, the other contract stated that if either party defaults in the performance of the contract, that party would be liable to the other for attorney's fees incurred in suing the defaulter. So then the 15 days late in completing the contract, some of the work was successful. The suit by the buyer against the contractor, the contract is saying that he is not liable for the buyer's attorney's fees because he has made only a defective performance and because the fall is a pretty exploded that is not performed for the contract. So the contract is liable for the attorney's fees.
You don't know draft of the contract. Why is that important? Because if there's an ambiguity in the language of a contract, it's going to be construed against the party to draft it. And it's a little bit ambiguous what that means. But you're 61 days late and was defective. So isn't they going to have to pay those attorney's fees? Yeah. And if you're going to be drafting a contract, you know, you don't have to be a lawyer to draft a contract, folks. If you're going to be running a business and you want to have a standard form contract, you can do it. If you want to put something like that in there, make sure you put, if you want them to make sure they have to pay the entire attorney's fee, put actual attorney's fees. If you want to make sure that that an attorney doesn't rip somebody off and excessively charge, as some lawyers do, you put reasonable attorney's fees. Okay, so next time, we're going to shoot through sales in just a few weeks. All those sales, and I don't know whether we're going to have problems, trying to do problems, but most of our cases that we're going to do on that night are sales problems. So we're going to be doing sales problems when our court discusses. So we may not have time to do any of the plan, but we're going to do all those sales after. Because a lot of the same as Commonwealth contracts is not that much material. We're going to focus on the changes the UCC made. About 7 or 8 of them.